Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning. I'm Michelle Bernard, in for Roland Martin. Next on the two-hour News One Now, this morning we're learning more about Donald Trump's executive order to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, including his plan to scrap subsidies to health insurance companies that help pay the out-of-pocket expenses of low-income Americans. Will this 1-2 punch weeks before open enrollment land the decisive blow? I'll put that question to our panel. Now, once again, President Trump takes to Twitter to blast hurricane-torn Puerto Rico, unleashing a firestorm of criticism and a charge of genocide from the mayor of San Juan. Administration officials rushed to clarify that FEMA would stand with Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands throughout their recovery. We'll have the latest. The Trump administration likes to use Chicago as the poster child for an urban war zone and failed gun control. But what's fueling Chicago's gun violence is more complicated than the president and his gun rights allies would like to admit. We'll discuss how that city is getting its guns with Chicago reporter Nick Dumke. And the movie Marshall opens up this weekend in theaters around the country. Yesterday, we visited the Thurgood Marshall Center here in Washington, where we spoke to the center's president, Thomasina Yearwood, and one of its board members, civil rights attorney Donald Temple, about Marshall's legacy and how he still inspires us today. And what would you do if you found out that you were related to a vicious Nazi commandant? That's what happened to Jennifer Tiga, who wrote a book about the revelation and how she came to terms with it. She'll be here to talk about it. This is News One Now. Still reeling from his third failed attempt to abolish the Affordable Care Act with a Republican-controlled Senate, Donald Trump made his most aggressive move yet by threatening to stop billions of dollars in government subsidies to insurers. Yesterday, Trump signed an executive order that would offer cheaper health insurance plans with less coverage and fewer protections and allow small businesses to band together to buy insurance across state lines. But late last night, the White House acknowledged they also plan to scrap the ACA's long-contested subsidies, which health insurance companies say they need to help pay out-of-pocket costs of low-income people.
It directs the Department of Health and Human Services, the Treasury, and the Department of Labor to take action to increase competition, increase choice, and increase access to lower-priced, high-quality health care options. And they will have so many options. This will cost the United States government virtually nothing, and people will have great, great health care. And when I say people, I mean by the millions and millions.
Now, the move comes just weeks before the ACA's open enrollment begins. If insurance companies do not get those payments, the Congressional Budget Office says premiums would rise by 20% next year. The White House put out this statement. The bailout of insurance companies through these unlawful payments is yet another example of how the previous administration abused taxpayer dollars and skirted the law to prop up a broken system. Congress needs to repeal and replace the disastrous Obamacare law and provide real relief to the American people. Democrats are outraged. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer tweeted last night, and I quote, "It is a spiteful act of vast pointless sabotage leveled at working families and the middle class in America, in every corner of America." Let me go to our panel today. Barbara Arnwine, founding president of Transformative Justice Coalition, Brandon Cooper, chairman of the Prince George's County Republican Party, and Amber J. Phillips, co-host of Black Joy Mixtape Podcast. So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't even know where to begin. We just, or I guess we're just going to keep going and going and going until we can find a way to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. One of the first things that strikes me is, how is this not going to cost the American public anything?
course, it's going to cost the American public, and it's going to cost a lot of individuals their health care, their lives, their best health. This is one of the most vicious things this administration has done. And I think that, you know, we already knew this was an elitist-oriented administration that only cares about the upper class, the rich, but now they have directly attacked the poor.
And what I don't understand is it is the poor that you know overwhelmingly voted for Donald Trump, the quote unquote forgotten man, the part of white America that feels, you know, disillusioned, feels like the government has left them behind. If you go back and you look at all of these YouTube videos, for example, of constituents in Republican congressional districts saying, "You're going to kill my husband, you're going to kill my wife, you're going to kill my child. We have to have health insurance." Brandon, like, what's the strategy here?
Yeah.
What's the re-election strategy if you're taking away yeah. health insurance from the very people who voted you into office?
Right. The strategy, I think, as we all clear, is kind of mute. Is confusing, to say the least. But I hate this idea that there's only two dichotomies. Either you love Trump or you hate Trump. I happen to be not in either of those positions. I'm in the middle. This issue of
that you can find something to like about him.
I love to be able to get like 20 seconds of my thought out.
Okay. Okay.
I love the Alabama today. I love it. I'm on a panel of beautiful ladies today. But so my point is this: there are 28 million people right now who do not have coverage of Obamacare. And so let's stop pretending like everything Obamacare is perfect. You heard Bill Clinton last year during the campaign said there's anything to be fixed with Obamacare. So I don't agree
with
that. Let me finish. I don't agree with the whole let's repeal everything, you know, replace. I feel like that strategy is failing. But there are parts of Obamacare that are broken. This is another
Democrat's
what agreed.
Doing.
Let me go
it's
back. So this subsidy has already been deemed unconstitutional by the lower courts. It's going to go away because it's already been deemed unconstitutional. It's upraised. Right now it's on appeal. It's at DC Circuit Court, but it's already been deemed unconstitutional because the way it's done, Congress is supposed to provide funding. It wasn't provided that way. So that's one thing with that. But also, let's look at the other things that he's done. He's also done yesterday. And again, I'm not in favor of all that he's done. But in addition to what you guys are talking about right now, the subsidies, there was also the move to allow those 28 million people who don't have health insurance, most of those people are low-wage workers with restaurants, allowing them to come together like the big corporations do.
Instead of allowing employers.
Exactly. So that's something that's needed. I mean, we're allowed to buy across state lines. So I think in over yesterday's statement, there was something that I think you can take on both sides of it. You look at the full issue and not, you know, always in the political lens that we do sometimes.
As we continue to say, there is no replacement measure here. Lots of us remember before Obama was in office the videos of people in packing emergency rooms. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about this is affecting the poor, let's be very clear. Our idea of what poor is very false.
Yes.
It moves around. The majority of Americans, regardless of income, unless you are a billionaire like Donald Trump, the majority of Americans cannot afford their health care bills, especially when it's an emergency. Especially when we talk about cancer, which the government is also helping to support by not having environmental protections in place,
8 years
by
after not having, it still can't afford.
Yeah. No,
I'm agreeing with you.
But what I'm saying is, Obamacare takes us in a step to address that.
Some parts of it,
even having health care at $200 a month or whatever your monthly fee is better than having no health care. By having Obamacare in place, it gives us a starting place to make it better. If Trump or any of the Republicans cared about that, they would have spent the 8 years trying to improve Obamacare instead of just repealing it.
I agree.
Ultimately, the answer to all of this is November 6, 2018. That's the answer.
You know, and I will tell you,
November
Justice
6,
John Roberts has surprised us repeatedly on the Supreme Court. I think if it goes to the Supreme Court, I don't think it's going to be deemed unconstitutional. I think the lower courts are wrong. I think it's going to be found unconstitutional.
I think the public wants health care, but more than that,
I think Justice John Roberts is going to surprise the Trump administration just as he has surprised everyone else, and it's going to be found constitutional.
Absolutely.
Thank you. We're moving on. Let's move on to our next story. As Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands continue their struggle in the aftermath of Hurricanes Irma and Maria, leaving many without electricity, running water, and fuel to keep generators going, we begin today by taking you back to September 29th, when Donald Trump made a promise.
We will not rest, however, until the people of Puerto Rico are safe. These are great people.
The storms killed at least 45 people on Puerto Rico alone, but yesterday, President Trump went on the attack via Twitter. In three successive tweets, Trump blamed Puerto Rico's leadership, referring to a financial crisis largely, and I'm quoting, of their own making, then adds that electric and all infrastructure was disaster before hurricanes. We cannot keep FEMA, the military, and the first responders who have been amazing in Puerto Rico forever. Condemnation was swift, with San Juan's mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz saying the president's tweet added insult to injury, referring to the incident he tossed towels to hurricane victims when he visited earlier this month. Cruz responded to Mr. Trump via a text message to U.S. Congressman Luis Gutierrez. Cruz wrote that while you are amusing yourself throwing paper towels at us, your compatriots and the world are sending love and help. She asked the UN, among others, to stop what she called the genocide that will result from the lack of appropriate action of a president that just does not get it. Representative Gutierrez furiously demanded why people aren't being evacuated to the U.S. mainland.
My friends who stand in line for hours for food if they can find it, my constituents worried about their family members, and 5 million Puerto Ricans in the diaspora have run out of patience. We want our people free to live in the United States of America wherever they can. Mr. Speaker, my constituents want the government to help get their families out of danger's way.
Now, Speaker Ryan is heading to Puerto Rico today with a bipartisan delegation, but they won't see the pitch-black nighttime conditions that island residents are dealing with right now. The House late yesterday passed a $36.5 billion disaster relief bill that includes money for both Puerto Rico and the United States Virgin Islands. FEMA tweeted that it isn't going anywhere, but while the White House chief of staff had some reassuring words, he says the president is right.
This country, our country, will stand with those American citizens in Puerto Rico until the job is done. But the tweet about FEMA and DOD, read military, is exactly accurate. They're not going to be there forever. And the whole point is to start to work yourself out of a job and then transition to the rebuilding process.
Now, joining us now via Skype from Boston is Julio Ricardo Varela, co-host of In the Think and founder of Latino Rebels. Good morning. Hey. Thank you so much for joining us. So, you know, if you look at what we saw by the president's chief of staff yesterday in the White House briefing room and compare that to the president's tweet himself, it sounds like we're hearing two very, very different things. I would guess that most of the American public understands that FEMA and the U.S. military are not going to be in Puerto Rico, Texas, or Florida forever. But there's a stark contrast, and what we heard from the chief of staff is not what the president said. At least that's my feeling about it. What's your take?
I just want to thank the president for making me feel extra colonial the last 24 hours, because he's done an amazing job reminding every Puerto Rican how second-class citizens they are. It's really interesting. The president of the United States has yet, and you can look at the transcripts, he has yet to say that Puerto Ricans are American citizens. Mm. It's always John Kelly, it's always Mike Pence, or even Melania Trump. But when President Trump has never said in the last 3 weeks during this entire debacle that Puerto Ricans are American citizens. So it just goes to show you that those tweets, the fact that this is all Puerto Rico's making, is just not accurate. First of all, it's just insulting, but it's just not true. The United States is just at fault being the colonizer for this financial mess. You know, this is not just Puerto Rico's political class, and I am very critical of Puerto Rico's political class as well. Yes, Puerto Rico has problems, but it also has an accomplice, and that accomplice is the United States of America. So for President Trump to tweet the fact that this is all Puerto Rico's fault is just beyond comprehension.
It seems evil to me. I mean, first of all, how does the financial crisis in any way whatsoever, how do you connect the financial crisis in Puerto Rico to the fact that that the island has virtually been completely destroyed by the hurricane? There's no connection. And you know, and I used to wonder if the president realizes that people in Puerto Rico are American citizens. And now it is beginning to really feel that he realizes that they're American citizens, but they are brown. People speak Spanish, and it seems intentional. Does it feel intentional to you?
It totally feels intentional. A couple of things about that financial crisis that people need to understand. Austerity that was caused by a bipartisan legislation that, to be honest with you, was President Obama and the Republicans, that has led to no money in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. So the fact that all these mayors, they don't have money to prepare for hurricanes. So yes, the financial crisis has directly impacted it, but let's not pretend that this is all Puerto Rico's fault. And for President Trump to say that it is that whole feeling of like, you don't belong here, you're not good enough, we're the colonizer, you're the colony. He might as well just become this early 20th century colonial governor and come in and say like, if it wasn't for us, the United States, we wouldn't be able, you poor backwards people wouldn't have anything. And that's the part that no one's really kind of diving deep into. And mm-hmm. it's just incredibly insulting.
Yeah, the mayor of San Juan has been incredibly well-spoken on this issue and explaining to the American public exactly what she believes Donald Trump stands for. You are doing the same. We want to thank you for everything that you're doing, and we are all praying for Puerto Rico and hoping that Puerto Rico gets all of the help it needs and is treated as an equal citizen with all of the people in Texas and in Florida as well. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next on News One Now, for the past few years, Chicago has been engulfed in a wave of gun violence and death. But the story has many layers, and neighboring states play a role. We'll speak with a reporter who has been investigating how Chicago gets its guns. And with a new movie about the late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall opening across the country this weekend, we'll take you to the center that is working to advance his legacy and speak with author Juan Williams. Stay tuned.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Whenever he discusses crime and guns in America, Donald Trump always brings up Chicago. This is what he said about the city shortly after taking office.
It's horrible carnage. This is, Afghanistan is not like what's happening in Chicago. People are being shot left and right.
In June, Trump pointed to Chicago again, tweeting, quote, "Crime and killing in Chicago have reached such epidemic proportions that I am sending in federal help. 1,714 shootings in Chicago this year." The federal help to which Trump referred was 20 agents from the Bureau of Tobacco, Alcohol, and Firearms dispatched to Chicago to work with local enforcement in targeting gun trafficking. To be sure, gun violence in Chicago is a serious problem. As of the end of September, the city recorded nearly 500 people killed and over 2,800 others wounded by gun violence this year. And nearly 7,000 firearms have been confiscated. But although Chicago and the state of Illinois have tough gun restrictions that include requiring licenses and permits, as well as a waiting period to purchase firearms, many of the guns that flow into Chicago are from the neighboring states of Indiana and Wisconsin, who have far more lax gun laws. Joining us by Skype from Chicago is Mick Dumke, a reporter for ProPublica, Illinois. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I've been reading a lot that you have been writing on this issue and really find it intriguing that the president and the administration are not giving the American public more of an explanation of exactly what is happening in Chicago and why. And could you just give us, enlighten us a little bit about how guns are getting into Chicago?
Well, I think the best way to explain it actually comes from a young man who is in federal prison, I've been writing back and forth with, who was caught up in this gun case that we ended up zooming in on a story that came out earlier this week.
Is that Bob Jones?
This guy's name is Wesley Pickett, actually, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and he's in a federal prison in Pennsylvania. And when I asked him where guns are coming from in Chicago, he said, "It's hard to say because they come from everywhere." Mm-hmm. And I think that it's the absurdity of that comment gets right at what's going on here. It really doesn't matter to some degree what regulations there are in the city of Chicago. There are no gun stores in Chicago, but as you noted just a few minutes ago, 7,000 illegally transferred weapons have ended up here and have been found by police so far this year alone. So as you noted, they're coming in from all the surrounding states and from some parts of Illinois outside of the city as well.
Now, tell me a little bit about his case. I read about someone else, and I don't know if it's the same person, but I read, for example, that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, you know, at least with one individual I read about, actually found out that this person was you know, suffering a personal financial crisis, needed money. This was not someone who was you know, engaged in criminal activity. Was certainly not a gun dealer, and basically enticed him into selling guns. And the man actually took, you know, the few hundred dollars he made to buy diapers, you know, food for his daughter. He was a primary caregiver, but this was not someone who was originally a gun dealer, and he ended up doing time for it. And, you know, and it seems to me that what they should be doing is going after the actual gun dealers.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the story we zoomed in on, the gentleman I quoted just a minute ago was another defendant in the same case.
Okay.
We focused on a character by the name of John Thomas, who, as you noted, just a couple of days ago, actually reported to federal prison in Illinois. And in 2014, he was desperate for money. He had a young infant daughter, and basically a confidential informant for the ATF ended up enticing him into doing gun deals. And they did a lot of them over the next few months. John Thomas himself was involved in like 23 different transactions involving a total of 77 guns. And that's not a small number, as the judge noted at his sentencing a few weeks ago. But as you pointed out, there's no evidence John was ever involved in selling guns before the government started spending taxpayer money to set up these buys.
Exactly, and to entice them to it. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a lot of guns. And obviously there's a huge problem in Chicago, but I believe I read that he made $700 and said that was the most money he'd ever made. And he's gonna do a lot of time after being enticed to do this by the government.
Yeah, I mean, at the time he had a legit job that was paying him only like $125 a week. So he was really scraping by. And I think over the course of 7 months, he made several thousand dollars total. So he still wasn't making very much money. We're still talking about maybe a couple hundred bucks in the average week. But there was more money than he had going on at the time. And, you know, John is the first person to say, look, I did it, I'm guilty, I need to pay my penalty. But basically the government created a gun market here. We do have problems with illegal guns flowing into the city, but in this particular case, and many like it, the government through its setups and its sting operations actually creates a gun network and then works to dismantle it.
Mr. Dumpke, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and thank you for your reporting. I'm going to go to my panel, Barbara Arnwine, Brandon Cooper, and Amber J. Phillips. Amber, let's talk to you first. One of the things that I was struck with when he said that the government has created this the gun market in Chicago, and you know, my brain immediately goes to allegations that the government created the crack epidemic in the United States, and who does it have a disproportionately negative impact on? Our people.
Right.
What did you think about that?
I also heard him talk about this lack of access to jobs and employment. And to me, that is, if we're talking about guns and violence in Chicago, if we don't start at those root causes, we are talking about a short-term solution for a problem that has had a long-term impact on Chicago.
Yeah.
So yes, we can have this conversation about gun violence, and I appreciate the work that he's doing to get deeper about where these guns are coming from, but we also need to hear these triggers around people are scraping by to survive.
Yes.
The government is creating a system in which scraping or finding alternatives to scraping by are much more lucrative than what we can do with minimum wage or the lack of government funding towards people in communities in Chicago. And I think that's an important point to know.
Brandon, so I wanted to touch base with you. So he's telling us that we've got these guns in Chicago coming in from Wisconsin, Indiana. We've got Republican governors. They are, you know, pro-gun rights. Making Chicago seem as if it is some sort of jungle with all of the people there killing themselves. What's the solution? What do you think is the solution that we're going to see coming out of the Republican Governors Association? We know what Trump thinks.
Yeah, a couple of things. And I say, again,
unconscionable why he continues to harp on Chicago. I think it's about, you know, feeding to his base or whatever and doing that stuff. Actually, Baltimore per capita has worse violence than Chicago. But I'm agreeing 100% with Amber. I think that the issue of gun violence in Chicago, if you look beneath the layers, it's a socioeconomic issue and also just a culture of violence. Everybody's talking about guns, but if you look at stabbing rates, assault rate, rapes, all that stuff is higher in the United States and other countries as well. So it's not just guns. And if you look at statistics, there's not a statistic that shows that gun ownership or higher gun ownership means higher gun violence.
Yeah.
It is not the case. Since the last 20 years, 50% higher increase in gun ownership in America, and gun violence has dropped 50%. So I think when you focus on the issue of guns, you're missing the cause of it. The cause of it is much lower and deeper into the community and longer standing than, you know, the gun issue. But I do agree, like you said, the facts are that a lot of the guns, I think 60% of the guns, are coming in from outside of Chicago. So that's definitely an issue that needs to be looked at.
Barbara, I was going to come to you, but we have to go to break, so I'm going to come back to you after the break.
That's fine.
News One Now, we'll be right back.
Don't leave. My audience knows very well what we talk about.
I know the consequences.
A second hour of News One Now starts next.
Are you serious?
Don't you just love it when there's video?
News One Now continues on TV One.
The movie Marshall, which tells the story of the early career of the country's first black Supreme Court Justice, Thurgood Marshall, opens nationwide in theaters today. With the country about to get a fresh look at the legal legend, News One Now visited the Thurgood Marshall Center here in Washington. The center's president, Thomasina Yearwood, and one of its board members, civil rights attorney Donald Temple, talked about Marshall's legacy and the work that the late justice still inspires today.
The Thurgood Marshall Center for Service and Heritage, which is the actual name of the building, has a great impact on the community because we focus on children, youth, and families. And with the tenants in the building, they provide various programs that help support the community. Mrs. Marshall, before Thurgood passed, they talked and they were so excited to have Thurgood's name on the building. Mrs. Marshall is our honorary board chair. She's been so active with the organization, and they just felt that this would be what Thurgood would want as in the future, to have his name, service and heritage. He certainly was about both. Initially, this building was the Anthony Bowen YMCA, the first African-American YMCA in the country. And people recognized it as the 12th Street Y, since we're located on 12th Street. The building was so important because back in the day, it was the mainstay for African Americans here in the district. They could not go to hotels, so they could be housed here at this Y. They could not have certain privileges in the restaurants and various places in the community. So you found them here, the youth coming. There was a swimming pool on the ground floor. There was the gymnasium that many activities were held. Actually, Coach John Thompson of the Georgetown basketball team was founded here in the gymnasium. And so it has been a place where African Americans could come, feel comfortable, support each other, which was very important. We currently are working on the Thurgood Marshall Society, a program that will uplift youth, give them something to look forward to be able to work together as a team. They don't have that right now, and we want to be that place where youth want to be and they want to excel.
Thurgood Marshall, under the tutelage of Charles Hamilton Houston, and that's a name that we shouldn't forget, because Houston taught Marshall. Houston brought Marshall along and mentored him. They lived in Jim Crowism. They saw schools where black children didn't have books, didn't have resources, where teachers were underpaid. They saw black people walking down the street not being able to look in the face of a white person. They saw lynchings. They saw mobs. They saw white people in courts with weapons in the South. And so they saw American apartheid at its zenith. They realized that you had to use the law as a tool for social change. And so Houston and Marshall are almost hand in glove in that regard, and their vision was black empowerment. And maybe not that same way, but black empowerment, the ability to participate in the opportunities, to enjoy the privileges, but then to have create people who would then reinvest. Wouldn't it be important for a 16 or a 17 or 18-year-old to know about Thurgood Marshall's Sweat B. Painter case in Texas involving voting rights? Wouldn't it be important for them to know about Brown? Wouldn't it be important for them to know about his personal struggle, how he grew up in Baltimore and his work experience? Wouldn't it be important for them to know that Marshall went to Howard Law School and Houston went to Harvard Law School and Marshall's from Baltimore and Houston is from D.C.? Wouldn't it be important for them to know that Marshall went to the Supreme Court and won 10 cases at the Supreme Court, or that Lyndon Johnson was so impressed with Marshall that he made him the Solicitor General and to set him up to become a Supreme Court Justice, and that Marshall was on the court with so many conservative white judges and liberal white judges, but Marshall was brilliant in his articulation of issues on a consistent basis, not just black issues, but American issues and social issues, but especially issues that affected our civil rights. If you look at Plessy and you look at Brown, what they did was move the American system away from this notion of institutional segregation is acceptable. That at that point in 54, 55, that after that point, it's no longer. And what we have to preserve is us moving back to the place where it was for many years before they conquered that battle. I teach students because I want students to be motivated and inspired. I want them to wake up and look in the mirror, and the mirror is not cracked. I want them to see a world full of possibilities, males and females, young people all over the country, to know that the world belongs to them. That's the Marshall legacy, that there's nothing that they can't do, and that we arm themselves, we arm them with knowledge. That's why the Marshall Society is so important, because it gives us that opportunity, that conduit, to bring lawyers and doctors and engineers and people to teach our kids how to think, how to analyze, and then how to convert hope into pragmatism and actuality.
Joining us via FaceTime from New York is Juan Williams, author of Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary and Fox News Analyst. Good morning, Juan. Thanks so much for joining us.
What a pleasure, Michelle. And this is such a ripe moment to talk about Justice Marshall. We have the movie coming out. I just saw a copy of Time magazine. They're doing a special edition dedicated to Thurgood Marshall.
Just absolutely wonderful. So I want to dig right in. I can't wait to get through the book. What was the most surprising thing you learned about Thurgood Marshall that you didn't know in writing the book?
You know, it's such a big question because I worked 7 years on Justice Marshall's story. It's so rich. I'll tell you one thing that amazed me is if you go back and you realize that he went to high school with Cab Calloway, you know, he's in college at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania with people like Langston Hughes, with several African leaders who go on to be presidents of, you know, African nations. And later that he's involved as a lawyer, not only in terms of America's young students breaking through with Brown, but with people like Joe Lewis, Jesse Owens. You know, that all of these people living in that segregated world came into contact with each other in a way that today I think we'd be surprised at.
Yeah, you know, and it was your take that he was a very humble man? You know, obviously, I never got to meet him or know him, but just the feeling that you get in anything we've ever read about him was that he was very humble.
I would agree. You know, when I talked to the lawyers who knew him, including his colleagues on the Supreme Court of the United States, they would describe him sometimes as just funny, open, and willing to listen. You know, you get to the top of the legal profession, you get on the Supreme Court, oftentimes you're more anxious to talk. But people valued Marshall because he had so much experience and was willing to listen so he could help them better understand the realities out on the street, what he had seen. I mean, he's the only Supreme Court justice that ever had to defend someone who was facing the death penalty. And in fact, the only one who knew that what it meant to lose. He defended people who were charged with dealing with back alley abortions. You know, this is the reality. I mean, Thurgood Marshall understood the streets from Baltimore to Harlem to Washington. And I think it brought what you described, Michelle, a sense of humility, but I think almost like a gritty sense of reality to his practice of the law.
How would you describe, or what can you tell us about his relationship with Clarence Thomas and what his thoughts might have been about being who he was and what he stood for and being replaced with a very different African-American man, and that person being Clarence Thomas?
Oh, sure. So this is a very complicated relationship, but let me just start by saying that when Clarence Thomas was confirmed after the great hullabaloo about Anita Hill and all that, one of his first tasks was to go and visit Thurgood Marshall at the Supreme Court. And it was supposed to be basically, Michelle, just a courtesy meeting where they would go in and shake hands. It ended up being a three-hour meeting. And according to both men, Marshall did almost all of the talking and explained to Clarence Thomas, you know, look, the court's a family. You're going to do what you have to do, given your politics or whatever. But you have to understand that up here, what we're trying to do is represent the American people, deliver on the quality of law, and especially between the two of us in terms of the future of Black America. I was surprised at how the two of them in that moment joined. Now, let me just say, I also heard from Bill Coleman, who was Thurgood Marshall's good friend, a famous lawyer in his own right, one of, I guess it's Gerald Ford's cabinet secretaries, the Secretary of Transportation. Bill Coleman told me that Thurgood Marshall, when he visited him during the Thomas hearings, basically was distraught, couldn't believe it, you know, thought, oh my gosh, look at this guy. This guy's going to replace me. So he was not Clarence Thomas' advocate. And finally, Clarence Thomas had written a piece in the Howard University Law Review that questioned Marshall's strategy in Brown, basically said, why didn't you focus on quality education for Black kids instead of integration, which of course integration then stirred up so many controversies with regard to massive resistance initially, but then arguments over busing, over tracking, all these things. And Thomas was of an idea that we want to make sure our kids just get a good education, even if they're with other Black kids only.
Yeah.
And Marshall's response to that was, you know, I wasn't trying to create some Norman Rockwell picture of Black and white and Asian and Latino kids. I was putting pressure on white-led school boards to deliver on resources and good teachers and good buildings for Black children, because they would know that if Black children could go to school anywhere, they would, and white children could have to go to school with them, they would have to improve the quality of facilities for Black children. Because remember, Black schools were often treated as, you know, kind of secondhand books, secondhand science facilities and experiments and playgrounds and the rest.
As they are still today with our education system by zip code. Thank you, Juan Williams, so much. Juan Williams, author of Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary, and Fox News Analyst. The movie Marshall opens nationwide in theaters today. Next on News One Now, author Jennifer Tiga made a shocking discovery. Her grandfather was a heinous Nazi commandant. She shares her experience in her book, My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me. A Black woman discovers her family's Nazi past. We'll talk to her, and we'll also talk with the co-founder of Appetite for Change, a community organization in North Minneapolis that's bringing a harvest to an area long considered a food desert. You're watching News One Now.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
About a decade ago, Jennifer Tiga discovered her grandfather was Eamon Goth, the butcher of Plaszow, the evil Nazi commandant who was featured in the movie Schindler's List. Her discovery took her to Israel and Krakow, Poland, to learn more about her ancestry and come to terms with it. The result, her book, My grandfather would have shot me, a black woman discovers her family's Nazi past. Joining us from Skype from Hamburg, Germany, is Jennifer Tiga, author of My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me, a black woman discovers her family's Nazi past. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. I find this absolutely fascinating. I was telling you during one of the breaks, I watched an interview of you on German television a few weeks ago. So we are really absolutely thrilled to have us here today, have you here with us today. I want to jump right in and talk about the book, but mostly I wanted to first ask you if you could just recount a story I saw about how you discovered this. I believe you were in a library in Hamburg and were drawn to a book. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Good morning, Michelle. Yes, absolutely. Well, this was a moment that one could say divided my life into before and after. It was in a Hamburg library, a huge library. I was in the psychology section, not in the history section, what one might assume. And I saw a book on a shelf. It was a book, I could only read the spine. I didn't know the author, I didn't know the title of the book. And I pulled the book from the shelf, it had a red cover, and I saw a small black and white photograph on the side. It was a picture of a woman, and I could read the title, the subtitle, and it said, Monika Goetz, daughter of the concentration camp commandant from Schindler's List. One needs to know I was adopted as a child. So I started leaving through the book, through the pages of the book, and I saw there was text, and there were also photographs. And there was one photograph that reminded me of my biological mother. And there was another picture, a small picture of a woman that reminded me of my biological grandmother. And there was even a name under the picture. It was a caption and it said Ruth Irene Goetz. And that was the name of my biological grandmother. So very quickly I went through the rest of the book. And at the very end, I saw a summarization of biographical details. And these details perfectly matched the information that I had surrounding my adoption paperwork. So at that moment, it became clear to me that it was not just a random book I was holding in my hands. It was a book that told the story of my biological mother and my biological family. This is how I found out.
So explain to us then how did you come to be? Because we're obviously talking about Nazi Germany, and you know quite obviously are a black woman. So how did you end up being a descendant of this person?
Well, I am biracial. My father is Nigerian. My mother is German. My parents met, my mother is the daughter of Amon Goetz. Mm-hmm. Amon Goetz's name, many are not familiar with the name itself, but he became known to a wide audience because he was portrayed by Ralph Fiennes in the movie Schindler's List. So my biological grandfather was the commandant of a Nazi concentration camp.
And you, I believe, you went to visit the area where the concentration camp once stood. I guess it's an area now where you go for remembrance.
Yeah, that's true. Well, after I made the discovery, it was a period I was in a sort of shock because it was something that was not known to me. I mean, I was almost 40 years out at that time. I didn't know anything about that part of my identity. So to find out more and also to come to terms with the situation, I went to Krakow, and there's a memorial that I visited. Because I also have a very personal connection to Israel, to Jewish people. Without knowing anything about my family's, my biological family's historical past, I lived and I studied in Israel, so I speak fluently Hebrew. And somehow, with all what happened, I felt a need to go there, to see it by myself, to go there, to remember the victims. So yes, I went to Krakow, and it's very close. Krakow is the city that is very close to the former concentration camp. And I went there also to the villa that you know from the movie, to find out more and somehow to come to terms with the new situation that was very disturbing for me, because it was very scary and very frightening. Yes. To be to be blood related to someone like Amon Goetz is it wasn't easy.
You know, this is really just so fascinating. We're running a little bit short on time, but so I wanted to end by asking you, you know, how has this impacted your life now that you have found out about your heritage and you've written this book? What is different about your life now versus the life you had before you knew more about your family heritage?
Well, a lot of things changed. I mean, I was suffering depression for a long time, also because of the early deprivation, obviously, but also because of the shock of a toxic family secret what was kept. And today my life is different. I turned something, I would say, negative into something positive. I am in contact with lots of survivors, and I see that for them it's fantastic to see that the good line did not evolve in the way that they expected and that I'm so different. I mean, look at me. I mean, just the color of my skin. But that's one thing. What is even more important is the character, and I don't resemble him in that aspect at all. I believe in humanity first. I think is something that is essential for our society, and therefore I think to speak about it loudly to a wide audience is something that enriched my life and hopefully also the lives of many others.
Well, this is fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We'll be back with more on News One Now.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
We're back, and I'm going to take this time to go back to Barbara Arnwine. Barbara, I want to talk to you a little bit more about gun violence in Chicago. I promise to come back to you. Share your thoughts, please.
Yes, I just think that the whole segment reminded us that there's what you call dumb and lazy policing. Mm-hmm. Because using entrapment the way they did here, yes, instead of actually investigating and finding out who were the real dealers of guns in the streets.
And arresting them.
It was just a real waste of taxpayers' money. Yeah. And I think it's very important for us to insist on smart policing always.
So in addition to smart policing, quickly, what's the solution?
Well, the solution to me is what we were talking about earlier. I mean, every study that's been done in Chicago where they've gone in and actually offered young people jobs, gun violence goes down among those young people.
Yeah.
It disappears.
It's right. Basic. Amber, you spoke about
Shocking.
It earlier. It's just common sense.
It really
what
is.
Happens when you have a job, a good education, and a way out, and you don't have the government
or an art program.
And, exactly.
Give me anything. Give me options.
And programs to encourage the hiring of Chicagoans.
We're on a break.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Stay tuned for the second hour of News One Now.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Good morning. I'm Michelle Bernard, in for Roland Martin. Next on the two-hour News One Now. This morning, we're learning more about Donald Trump's executive order to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, including his plan to scrap subsidies to health insurance companies that help pay the out-of-pocket expenses of low-income Americans. Will this 1-2 punch weeks before open enrollment land the decisive blow? Roland caught up with Haitian rapper, musician, and actor Wyclef Jean at Howard University, my alma mater, recently, and talked to him about the DACA program and the importance of millennials voting. Change the culture of violence in America and the world is the theme of this year's fifth annual Week of Nonviolence, Justice, and Opportunities, hosted by Black Women for Positive Change. Stay tuned to learn how you can be a part of that change. Still reeling from his third failed attempt to abolish the Affordable Care Act with a Republican-controlled Senate, Donald Trump made his most aggressive move yet by threatening to stop billions of dollars in government subsidies to injuries. Stay tuned. This is News One Now. Still reeling from his third failed attempt to abolish the Affordable Care Act with a Republican-controlled Senate, Donald Trump made his most aggressive move yet by threatening to stop billions of dollars in government subsidies to insurers. Yesterday, Trump signed an executive order that would offer cheaper health insurance plans with less coverage and fewer protections and allow small businesses to band together to buy insurance across state lines. But late last night, the White House acknowledged they also plan to scrap long the ACA's long-contested subsidies, health insurance companies say they need to help pay out-of-pocket costs of low-income people.
It directs the Department of Health and Human Services, the Treasury, and the Department of Labor to take action to increase competition, increase choice, and increase access to lower-priced, high-quality health care options. And they will have so many options. This will cost the United States government virtually nothing. And people will have great, great health care. And when I say people, I mean by the millions and millions.
Yada, yada, yada. All right, so the move comes just weeks before the ACA's open enrollment begins. If insurance companies do not get those payments, the Congressional Budget Office says premiums would rise by 20% next year. The White House put out this statement last night. The bailout of insurance companies through these unlawful payments is yet another example of how the previous administration abused taxpayer dollars and skirted the law to prop up a broken system. Congress needs to repeal and replace the disastrous Obamacare law and provide real relief to the American people. Now, Democrats are outraged. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer tweeted last night, "It is a spiteful act of vast, pointless sabotage leveled at working families and the middle class in every corner of America." Let me reintroduce our panel today, Barbara Arnwine, founding president of Transformative Justice Coalition, Brandon Cooper, chairman of the Prince George's County Republican Party, and Amber J. Phillips, co-host of Black Joy Mixtape Podcast. So we're back. We're going to talk a little bit more about this. Barbara, I want to go to you first. I can't help but continue to think that the president and the Republican Congress are going to keep taking a shot at the ACA, not because Obamacare was disastrous, but because the president is obsessed with Barack Obama and seems to want to dismantle anything that the president did. Can you prove me wrong?
Well, there's still this whole throw raw meat at his base. Mm-hmm. And it's still this whole feeling that he has to engage in these dog whistles. Puerto Rico is a dog whistle.
Yes.
Everything he's doing is dog whistling. And it's just basically saying, base, stay with me, base, stay with me at all everybody else's expense.
Yeah.
And it's really wrong. You know, I had something happen recently where I had a, quote, gap in my insurance coverage. A medicine that I really need for my life went from $90 to $384 overnight. You know, that's just one.
Yes.
I mean, that's the reality that, and I had to say to myself, thank God I have income.
Yes.
But what about the people who don't?
Who absolutely do not.
And what kind of heart is this? A president is not just the president of his base and those who elected him. He's the president of the American people.
Absolutely.
And especially the poor.
Well, you know, Amber, I'm going to go to you because, you know, Barack Obama constantly had to prove to the American people that he was just not the president of Black America. He was president of the entire United States. Donald Trump is not doing that. He's got a very small constituency. But my question to you is, when, if ever, does that constituency wake up and say that the policies of the man that they brought into the presidency are harming them?
I think, and I've said this before, white America has typically voted against its best interests. And that goes with Donald Trump, too. I think they are willing to sacrifice their access to life-saving care in order to support him in, we talk a lot about fascism, but let's also talk about eugenics, which is the betterment of the race led by white supremacy to basically move poor people, people of color, to eliminate us. This attack on healthcare is a piece of eugenics. Not naming Puerto Rico as U.S. citizen is eugenics. Trying to deport families and separate families is eugenics. So I think a lot of the people who have willingly put this person in office are willing to forego their access to basic healthcare and clean air in order to eliminate a group of people that are U.S. citizens because of racism in this country.
So Brandon, let me ask you do, what's going to be the nail in the coffin when people wake up, and again, this is the president's constituency, when they wake up and look around and realize that it is not Black Americans, it is not Latinas or Latinos, it is not women who are responsible for the plight that they find themselves in. It is the education system, and it is politicians who look at them as being ignorant. Mm-hmm. When do they wake up and see that's the real situation here, and that their racism and sexism and, you know, and anti-Muslim beliefs are really what's destroying themselves, their communities, and the fabric of the country?
Yeah, the disconnect is real, and when that will happen, I don't know. I think it's, it didn't start in November 2017. Mm-hmm. 2016, this disconnect is going to be long hereafter Trump leaves. But to this topic about Obamacare, we talked about earlier, you said his rhetoric and how it's destructive. I agree. This move to repeal Obamacare is all about rhetoric, because if you look at the bill that they actually passed, that was the repeal, they tried to pass, that failed, mm-hmm. that they labeled repeal, it kept 80% of the Obamacare in there. So, I think we have to separate either we're going to talk about Trump's tweets and the rhetoric and all that, and, it'll take us all day to try to figure out what that means, or we can look at the actual policies.
I think he's clear with his tweets.
Talking about his tweets and stuff is rhetoric. I'm right with you.
But his tweets become policy. He will tweet out that he wants Muslims not a part of this country, and then the next day it becomes fact. He will tweet out that he doesn't want trans people in the military, and the next day it will become policy.
I think one of the reasons that we have to continue to talk about the tweets mm-hmm. is because they trickle down. We have no trickle down economics. That doesn't work, but trickle down racism works. Okay. We're out of time. We're gonna make a hard change here, switching gears, as hundreds of thousands of immigrant children brought into the United States illegally await their fate under the Trump administration. Our host, Roland Martin, recently had a chance to speak with Haitian musician Wyclef Jean about his thoughts on DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program created by President Obama that granted protections for them. Here's what he had to say.
You run for president, and then you come back to this generation. So it was important to come back. C3 is the carnival is important because it's the production style is the kids that were listening to the carnival at 12 years old. Now these are the kids producing for Drake, Super Mario. Mm-hmm. So the combination was Uncle Clef came in with the hardware, they came with the software, we put it together, and this whole sonics created the Carnival 3. Important for this generation because it's the fall and rise of a refugee, and all of these kids are relating to the new Wyclef Clef music like it's 1997. So it was important to not only do it on the internet, mm-hmm. like just stop by, come say, and Howard, this is where, I remember we performed here, JD, Fugees, Maxwell, this was homecoming for us. So it was important to come back.
And obviously, when you look at how DACA, when you look at how immigration policy affects us in this country, this generation is very much impacted.
I bet this is very important. And the reason why, DACA and that whole situation, as far as me, think about me, I wouldn't even be here. So if I was born within this time, I would be one of those kids affected by DACA, Also affected by TPS, also, with the idea of Haitian, with the quake being able to come.
Right.
Now with the law, I just got back from Canada a few weeks ago, and they got them in the dome, So we definitely have to do a form of awakening, Because we are, people every time I came here, and they said, these United States of America, we are the country's immigrants. So I think once we lose that sense, we're going to lose a lot.
You also believe that with this generation, this is what I said about Trump, is forced this generation to go, you might have thought stuff was in the past, but it's not. You now have to be in the moment, and you got to be in the game.
Well, I always tell people, I said the power of millennials are very important. And the thing is, because people was like, oh, they're not active. I was actually, they're very active, They're so active to the point where they really stay back and didn't vote. And I think now...
And that's active.
That's active. And I think now you have an awakening, And the awakening once again. But what I tell the kids is the president's term is 4 years. And it's so important for you to think ahead.
Chess, that's right.
7 moves ahead. So the idea is, as we move forward, what happened last time, and how don't you let that happen again?
There you go.
If you want to rock, you know what I mean? But once again, I'm just telling you, and I could just be honest with you, the kids right now, they're not either Republican or Democrat.
Issue-based, not party.
Issue-based, not party.
All right, man. Always good seeing you, baby.
Man. Good seeing you.
You think you will.
Still ahead on News One Now, world-famous entertainer and activist Hera Belafonte teams up with Black Women for Positive Change to talk about justice, opportunity, and nonviolence. And for the past few years, Chicago has been engulfed in a wave of gun violence and death. But the story has many layers, and neighboring states play a role. We'll speak with a reporter who has been investigating how Chicago gets its guns. All that next on News One Now.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
On October 15th through the 23rd in cities around the world, you do not want to miss out on the 5th annual week of nonviolence, justice, and opportunities. Hosted by the Black Women for Positive Change, this year's honorary chair is none other than songwriter, actor, civil rights giant Hera Belafonte. The event gives individuals and groups a chance to organize and promote nonviolence and peace in your neighborhood. To find out what's going on in your city, to plan an event, go to 2017weekofnonviolence.org. Here to talk more about the event are my guests, Karen Carrington, Washington National Co-Chair for Events and Media for Black Women for Positive Change. And joining us via Skype from Atlanta is Lucy McBath, National Spokesperson for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
So I'm going to, Lucy, let me go to you first. Thank you so much for being here with us this morning. Would you share with the audience a little bit how you got involved with the Week of Nonviolence and why? I know your story, but I don't want to tell your story for you.
Well, absolutely. Of course, you know, the organization that I work with, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, we do just this very thing. Our work is basically based upon nonviolence, gun violence prevention. And so my organization had an opportunity to work with the wonderful women that are doing this work and for this week. And so that's really how I became involved, had a chance to meet them in Washington, D.C., sit down and have a really wonderful talk, and was just so genuinely encouraged by the work that they're doing to create a very a nonviolent climate around the nation, not only within communities of color, but, you know, communities around the nation. And that's extremely important. That really ties directly into the work that I do with Moms Demand Action. So we're so excited to be a part of this. And I, in particular, so excited to be a part of this really important week.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm going to just turn quickly to Karen, but please don't leave us, Lucy. So we know the story that Lucy's son lost his life to gun violence mm-hmm. for playing his music too loud in Florida. And so, you know, given the current climate, the work that Black Women for Positive Change are doing is so important. One of the things that we've been talking about is de-escalation of violence through police, mm-hmm. Training, and all areas of violence in the country. Tell us a little bit about what we mean when we use the term de-escalation.
Well, we'll have to give the credit to Congresswoman Gwen Moore of
yes.
Wisconsin, who has entered legislation called H.R. 3060, which is called the Prevention of Violence Between Police and Communities Act. And as you well know, she is a sponsor of the National Week of Nonviolence. And she talks about the need to provide additional training to police officers to help de-escalate that tension that is in the community when they stop us. And it goes from training to changing a mindset of people who are in police and law enforcement to stop and cool off before firing a gun and injuring or killing a person for something that they may not have a weapon for, mm-hmm. they may have their hands up, and it's
they could be holding a can of iced tea and Skittles a toy gun.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, have be suffering from mental illness. And one of the things I have learned, I'm one of the co-chairs for the event this year. I'm very honored to do so. But one of the things that I have learned in working with Black Women for Positive Change is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but police officers receive training, for example, on how to deal with pulling somebody over in their car, how to deal with with a marijuana investigation.
Right.
But there's no real serious training on how to de-escalate a very tense situation.
That is very correct, and that is what inspired Congresswoman Moore to draft this legislation, because she had a constituent who was a homeless person sleeping on a bench. Mm-hmm. Police officer approached him, and as you well know, if you're asleep, if somebody takes a stick or anything at you, your natural reflex is to, you know, reach out, grab or whatever. This happened. This individual was shot 14 times, no weapon. Yeah. So as a result of this, she's been very proactive in wanting to ensure that policemen are given ample training on how to de-escalate situations. And it's very important, and it could save numerous lives. And as we've all witnessed over the number of years, there mm-hmm. is the number of people who are being killed as a result of not having de-escalation is continuing to rise.
Karen and Lucy, I'm going to bring our panel in now. Barbara, let me go to you first as my fellow lawyer. We are Black Women for Positive Change in the Week of Nonviolence are hosting a video town hall meeting on Tuesday, October 17th at the University of North Carolina Central University Law School. So I want to bring the lawyers in and thank them for hosting us on Tuesday. From a legal perspective, I want to ask you, what do you think? I've taken a look at Representative Moore's legislation. The idea behind it is fantastic. One of my worries in reading the legislation is that states that receive funding and are supposed to do these de-escalation tactics would have to prove to the Office of the Attorney General that they are doing what they're supposed to do. From an enforcement perspective, a legally enforcement perspective, what would you worry about if you hear about that and you know that Jeff Sessions is the Attorney General?
Right. I mean, we have to worry about everything because he doesn't care about this issue. But what it does mean, and what's the brilliance of what Gwen Moore is doing, and by the way, I love Black Women for Positive Change.
Thank you.
That is such
we
a powerful
well.
Language. And a big shout out to the Eagles at North Carolina Central University, but where I was teaching at the law school last year. But I just wanted to say that it's really important for communities mm-hmm. to also make these demands.
Absolutely.
You don't need federal legislation. If you go to your city council and your county commissioner mm-hmm. and say who are over the police force in that area and say that this is something that should be happening as part of our policing, mm-hmm. that we need to have de-escalation, because it's very true that people are being shot every day, people in wheelchairs, people
that's
who are
true.
Deaf. Who can't hear an order that's being issued. People like Freddie Gray, who was suffering from lead poisoning mm-hmm. and was running because that's what people with lead poisoning do when they're confronted by a dangerous or threatening situation. All of these things require better trained police. Mm-hmm. And we need to demand it as communities. It should be legislation, obviously, at the federal level, but we need to demand it at every county, every city, every municipal level.
Let me thank you. I'm gonna go back to Lucy, and I'll come back to the panel. Lucy, I'm playing devil's advocate just on what we just heard Barbara say. What would you say to the police officer who says, number one, de-escalation is defined. The way we define de-escalation depends on who you're speaking to, and that these communities that are asking for de-escalation, tactics to and training and police officers are really just looking for magic. They're looking for someone to pull a rabbit out of a hat, and it's not possible. What would your response be?
I would definitely debunk that kind of ideology simply because you've got to start someplace. And you have to make sure that police officers within their communities are building bridges, building connections and being able to work within the community. We know the biggest problems that we have with unlawful policing and the problems that we have within the communities is that law enforcement doesn't trust the community, the people, the citizens in the community. They're seen as the enemy and vice versa. So definitely you have to have a starting point. And I would definitely debunk any thought or ideology that, you know, would squash people being able to work together for a common good to de-escalate the violence. Also the violence, you know, through gun violence, which is very rampant in all of our communities. So you have to start someplace. You have to have an open mind. Everyone should be willing to come to the table with some kind of thought process in mind to try to change what we see happening within our communities with violence.
Thank you so much. We've got a minute. Amber, I'm going to turn to you. We've got this peace pledge. I don't know. I'm going to hold it up to the camera. I don't know if you all can show it. But we've got a peace pledge. Black Women for Positive Change are hoping that people will sign it. It says, I pledge to uphold peace in the name of nonviolence and to work to keep my brothers and sisters safe. I promise to seek the path of peace and to treat others with fairness and respect. I pledge to do this for the sake of humanity so we can all live together in peace and harmony. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Millennials came up with this.
This is awesome. And I think a big theme of all of this, when you all mentioned what's causing some of these murders, my co-host of the Black Joy mixtape and I just did a TED talk called The Blueprint for the Black Joy Era. Lots of these interactions are black people just expressing joy, loud music.
Right.
Putting out a cigarette after a stressful police traffic pullover, those kind of things. And I think moments like this where we come together, we celebrate each other, we center our black joy is a part of that peace. And we need to get more of this public to recognize that what we're doing is just celebrating ourselves and our communities, that we're not a threat or violent. Sleeping is not violent or deviant. Mm-hmm. Our joy is not deviant. And I'm excited that this is happening. Thank you for your work.
Thank you so much. Thank you. We've got a few seconds, yeah. Brandon. I'm going to give you the last
quickly,
word before we go to break.
I want to echo that. I'm also excited to be sitting on an all-female panel and also with the Black Women for Change leading this movement. I think it's very important.
Thank you.
And you touched on a little bit about the public-private partnership. I just want to ask real quickly, and I know we got a quick time. If you look at, you know, the statistics of this violence, you know, 90% or plus of gun violence committed by males. You look at domestic violence, I think October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
Yes.
You know, 80% of that is committed by males. And so I'm part of 100 Black Men. We mentor young black boys, you know, to help them live better lives. My question is, from your perspective, what can we be doing in the private area? I know we talked about the public policy to impact, you know, it's not limited to one group, but largely males and the violence that, you know, we're seeing in our community.
Excellent question. This year, our theme is Keeping It Cool, Justice and Opportunities. Our youth need opportunities. Opportunities cause prevention, and prevention will help eliminate some of the violence, because when people's backs are pushed against the wall, as your Chicago segment indicated,
yes,
people need to be able to express themselves in a positive manner. But if you're hungry, you don't have a job, things happen, you know, in order to keep living. So we are promoting opportunities through prevention, and we are certainly encouraging legislators, community organizations to help partner with us to provide opportunities for our youth. There's so many activities like coding. It's all about providing, you know, youth opportunities. Coding is the new thing.
Yes. Yeah.
We need to channel that interest that people have into positive and productive segments.
We're going to end on that note, but I also want to note that men are part of the movement and our partners in change.
Our good brothers.
Lucy and Karen, thank you for joining us. Next on News One Now, we constantly hear the stories about Chicago's gun violence, but how are the firearms getting into a city with some of the tightest gun laws in the country? We'll get insight into Chicago's gun market and the young men who are getting caught up in it. You're watching News One Now.
Your centerpiece for black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Whenever he discusses crime and guns in America, Donald Trump always brings up Chicago. This is what he said about the city shortly after taking office.
It's horrible carnage. This is, Afghanistan is not like what's happening in Chicago. People are being shot left and right.
In June, Trump pointed to Chicago again, tweeting, quote, crime and killing in Chicago have reached such epidemic proportions that I am sending in federal help. 1,714 shootings in Chicago this year. The federal help to which Trump referred was 20 agents from the Bureau of Tobacco, Alcohol, and Firearms dispatched to Chicago to work with local enforcement in targeting gun trafficking. To be sure, gun violence in Chicago is a serious problem. As of the end of September, the city recorded nearly 500 people killed and over 2,800 others wounded by gun violence this year. And nearly 7,000 firearms have been confiscated. But although Chicago and the state of Illinois have tough gun restrictions that include requiring licenses and permits, as well as a waiting period to purchase firearms, many of the guns that flow into Chicago are from the neighboring states of Indiana and Wisconsin, who have far more lax gun laws. Joining us by Skype from Chicago is Mick Dumke, a reporter for ProPublica Illinois. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I've been reading a lot that you have been writing on this issue and, you know, really find it intriguing that the president and the administration are not giving the American public more of an explanation of exactly what is happening in Chicago and why. And could you just give us, enlighten us a little bit about how guns are getting into Chicago?
Well, I think the best way to explain it actually comes from a young man who is in federal prison, I've been writing back and forth with, who was caught up in this gun case that we ended up zooming in on a story that came out earlier this week.
Is that Bob Jones?
This guy's name is Wesley Pickett, actually, and he's in a federal prison in Pennsylvania. And when I asked him where guns are coming from in Chicago, he said, it's hard to say because they come from everywhere. And I think that it's the absurdity of that comment gets right at what's going on here. You know, it really doesn't matter to some degree what regulations there are in the city of Chicago. There are no gun stores in Chicago, but as you noted just a few minutes ago, 7,000 illegally transferred weapons have ended up here and have been found by police so far this year alone. So as you noted, they're coming in from all the surrounding states and from some parts of Illinois outside of the city as well.
Now, tell me a little bit about his case. I read about someone else, and I don't know if it's the same person, but I read, for example, that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, you know, at least with one individual I read about, actually found out that this person was you know, suffering a personal financial crisis, needed money. This was not someone who was you know, engaged in criminal activity, was certainly not a gun dealer, and basically enticed him into selling guns. And the man actually took, you know, the few hundred dollars he made to buy diapers, food for his daughter. He was a primary caregiver, but this was not someone who was originally a gun dealer, and he ended up doing time for it. And, you know, and it seems to me that what they should be doing is going after the actual gun dealers.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the story we zoomed in on, the gentleman I quoted just a minute ago was another defendant in the same case.
Okay.
We focused on a character by the name of John Thomas, who, as you noted, just a couple days ago actually reported to federal prison in Illinois. And in 2014, he was desperate for money. He had a young infant daughter. And basically, a confidential informant for the ATF ended up enticing him into doing gun deals. And they did a lot of them over the next few months. John Thomas himself was involved in like 23 different transactions involving a total of 77 guns. And that's not a small number, as the judge noted at his sentencing a few weeks ago. But as you pointed out, there's no evidence John was ever involved in selling guns before the government started spending taxpayer money to set up these buys.
Exactly, and to entice them to it. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a lot of guns. And obviously there's a huge problem in Chicago, but I believe I read that he made $700 and said that was the most money he'd ever made. And he's gonna do a lot of time after being enticed to do this by the government.
Yeah, I mean, at the time he had a legit job that was paying him only like $125 a week. So he was really scraping by. And I think over the course of 7 months, he made several thousand dollars total. So he still wasn't making very much money. We're still talking about maybe a couple $100 in the average week. But there was more money than he had going on at the time. And, you know, John is the first person to say, look, I did it. I'm guilty. Mm-hmm. I need to pay my penalty. But basically, the government created a gun market here. We do have problems with illegal guns flowing into the city. But in this particular case, and many like it, the government, through its setups and its sting operations, actually creates a gun network and then works to dismantle it.
Mr. Dumke, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and thank you for your reporting. I'm going to go to my panel, Barbara Arnwine, Brandon Cooper, and Amber J. Phillips. Amber, let's talk to you first. One of the things that I was struck with when he said that the government has created this the gun market in Chicago, and you know, my brain immediately goes to allegations that the government created the crack epidemic in the United States, and who does it have a disproportionately negative impact on? Our people.
Right.
What did you think about that?
I also heard him talk about this lack of access to jobs and employment. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is, if we're talking about guns and violence in Chicago, if we don't start at those root causes, we are talking about a short-term solution for a problem that has had a long-term impact on Chicago.
Yeah.
So yes, we can have this conversation about gun violence, and I appreciate the work that he's doing to get deeper about where these guns are coming from, but we also need to hear these triggers around people are scraping by to survive.
Yes.
The government is creating a system in which scraping or finding alternatives to scraping by are much more lucrative than what we can do with minimum wage or the lack of government funding towards people in communities in Chicago. And I think that's an important point to know.
Brandon, so I wanted to touch base with you. So he's telling us that we've got these guns in Chicago coming in from Wisconsin, Indiana. We've got Republican governors. They are, you know, pro-gun rights. Making Chicago seem as if it is some sort of jungle with all of the people there killing themselves. What's the solution? What do you think is the solution that we're going to see coming out of the Republican Governors Association? We know what Trump thinks.
Yeah, a couple of things. And I say, again, I'm unconscionable why he continues to harp on Chicago. I think it's about, you know, feeding to his base or whatever and doing that stuff. Actually, Baltimore, per capita, has worse violence than Chicago. But I'm agreeing 100% with Amber. I think that the issue of gun violence in Chicago, if you look beneath the layers, it's a socioeconomic issue and also just a culture of violence. Everybody's talking about guns, but if you look at stabbing rates, assault rate, rapes, all that stuff is higher in the United States and other countries as well. So it's not just guns. And if you look at statistics, there's not a statistic that shows that gun ownership or higher gun ownership means higher gun violence.
Yeah.
It is not the case. Since the last 20 years, 50% higher increase in gun ownership in America, and gun violence has dropped 50%. So I think when you focus on the issue of guns, you're missing the cause of it. The cause of it is much lower and deeper into the community and longer standing than, you know, the gun issue. But I do agree, like you said, the facts are that a lot of the guns, I think 60% of the guns, are coming in from outside of Chicago. So that's definitely an issue that needs to be looked at.
Barbara, I was going to come to you, but we have to go to break, so I'm going to come back to you after the break.
That's fine.
News One Now, we'll be right back.
Don't leave.
My audience knows very well what we talk about.
I know the consequences.
A second hour of News One Now starts next.
Are you serious?
Don't you just love it when there's video?
News One Now continues on TV One.
For decades, the nearly 70,000 residents of North Minneapolis have lived in a food desert with very few, if any, options to buy fresh and healthy produce. The community organization Appetite for Change is turning that around. Its urban farmers are growing food right in the North Minneapolis community, and nearby residents are reaping the health and financial benefits. Joining us now by FaceTime from Naples, Florida, is Latasha Powell, co-founder and director of programming for Appetite for Change. Good morning, Latasha. Thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you here. This is an issue that is so dear to my heart and to the hearts of everybody on the panel. Tell us what got you interested in working with Appetite for Change and doing the good work that you're doing.
What got me interested was I was kind of a struggling vegetarian, and being a Black woman in Minneapolis, and my family, there wasn't many or any in my family Black vegetarians. So I was struggling with trying to keep that diet and trying to find some fresh produce in my own community.
And so in your community, what did you find? You know, we've got communities here in the Washington metropolitan area that when you go and you look around, you can find a corner store with liquor and very few, no fresh produce. What were you seeing in your community?
Similar to same things, we have many corner stores, many fast food convenience stores along our West Broadway corridor. Our youth a couple of years ago had walked about a mile and a half radius to count all the corner stores, convenient fast food stores within a mile radius, and they counted 37. And they had concerns about that, and they was like, why in North Minneapolis where the it's a lot of black people and people of color there, why is this is a lot of fast food and convenience food in our neighborhood? We need real food for real people right here on North Minneapolis.
You know, and I think there's a misconception in the community that African Americans don't want to eat healthy food, you know, and prefer to eat what you find in the corner store, which is canned or cereal or basically liquor. But I mean, you know, what have you found in the community? What is the type of excitement that you're finding with youth, with their parents, about having access to healthy food?
We're finding out that black people and people in our community do want healthy food in their community. Many of our community members don't know all the different types of healthy food that's out there for them. It's because it's not in their community. So we like, do our people eat the food in their community because they want it, or do they eat the food in their community because it's there?
Yes.
So I know that getting out in the garden with the youth these days and introducing them into watch, planting the seed and watch the food grow, they are overexcited. And they love growing food once they be exposed to it.
Yeah. So we were just watching some video of some kids, and they look healthy. They look excited to be involved with Appetite for Change. What kind of involvement are you seeing from youth? Are they helping grow food? Are they helping sell it? Spread the word. What exactly are the youth doing?
The youth is doing an amazing job with Appetite for Change. Of course, they do help grow food. I've been in the garden working side by side with them, training them, not training, but showing them correct ways of how you should grow food. They're also a big part of our flagship program, which is Community Cooks, where we bring the community together to cook, eat, and talk. And we have a specific group for youth that they lead the dialogue, they lead the cooking workshops. They also help with some policy. So they go down to the Capitol and help advocate for laws to be changed to help them be able to sell and grow produce right in their community.
That's fantastic. Latasha, I'm gonna put a laugh on your face. If you had a hard time finding black vegetarians, you should see the time my husband and I have finding black vegans here in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Latasha, for joining us this morning. It was a pleasure. Still ahead on News One Now, R&B singer Kenny Lattimore stops by to discuss his latest project. Keep it locked right here on TV One.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Singer-songwriter Kenny Lattimore will release his seventh studio album, Vulnerable, today in stores and online. Lattimore's tour stopped here in D.C. recently, and while he was in town, he stopped by News One Now. His CD is in stores today. Here's what he had to say.
I was meant for you. All the time I spent with you, babe. Now don't mean a thing, no. What is done, we can't get it back. We can fight and fight and fight. That'll ruin my mind. I pushed you.
Push is my new single,
right?
And it's about guys like going through situations where they push somebody away.
Okay.
Because of sometimes fear, insecurity. Sometimes you need to push somebody away. But
That's true. Some folks should be kicked away.
Right. Absolutely.
That's right. Not pushed away, kicked away.
But you know, this particular song is like an apology to a woman that I have a real push story, and a lot of people do. I think almost everybody has a push story. Where, you don't have a push story.
There's some folk I just did not want in my life.
Okay, well, I had one where I was dating this young lady when I was living here in D.C.,
uh-huh.
And I was going to New York to start my career, and I felt like I don't know that you can go through the grind that I'm going to have to go through in order to make it in this industry and hold on to this relationship. So I pushed her away and apologized to her years later, like 15 years later.
So you didn't think she could go through it, but you didn't ask her.
I didn't even ask her.
And so you gave her no shot at even
no
trying
shot.
To it.
Yeah, so I had to go back to and apologize and let her know that, you know, it was your moment. And I took that away from you. So I apologize.
She's still mad?
No, she's good. She's good.
She
we all have gone on
mad.
In marriage. I hope not.
You,
man.
Yeah, you know she was.
You know who you are.
You know she's a little swole.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a real situation, I think, that a lot of people go through. And a lot of times for their careers, you know, women do this. And, you know, a lot of good guys get pushed away, too. But
yeah, men and women do it.
Men and women do it. Yeah, I try to just use my musical platform to speak to the hearts of women and to the minds of men and encourage them in love.
So well, I but see, I find it interesting because one of the things that I've always said is one of the biggest mistakes I think people make is that they don't look at someone. They look at someone to say, okay, this is where you are now.
Yes.
Versus what you can grow into.
Absolutely. And that whole process is what's precious and what actually matures the relationship. And if you don't allow anybody to go through it, you never get to that great end.
Now, the CD is called Vulnerable.
Vulnerable, yes.
Okay. I mean, that, obviously, that's a little different. So, you know, why that name?
You know, I think it's a combination of things for me. I think in my life right now, I'm in a state of vulnerability. I'm working from a business standpoint with a brand new company called Liger Enterprises. It's fantastic. Frank Thomas, we call him the Big Hurt, if you follow baseball, is one of our
Hall of Famers.
Yeah, Hall of Famer. And so this is new. That's a vulnerable situation for me as opposed to the big major labels. But at the same time in my life, I am getting kind of open to the dating thing again and trying to go through that cycle where I don't push the next lady away, you know, even in this level of my career and this particular time in my life as I go forward.
But why? I'm trying to understand, though, but why is that hard versus just letting something just happen?
Hollywood is a beast. And there's a lot of different twists and turns, I think, that are just unnatural in Hollywood. And I think even though I still look back and I go, my ex may have been able to handle the transition and everything. There's so much that goes on that is just unnatural and so intrusive.
All right, so you also touring around the country.
Touring around the country. You can go to KennyLattimore.com and see all of my tour dates because they change. So I don't ever want to just be like, yes, I'm going here. It changes frequently and we make a lot of additions. I have a newsletter, things there, so that if people are interested in being those super fans where I can, you know, communicate with them and let them know this is what's happening next or before the rest of the world knows, check out KennyLattimore.com.
You mentioned the new label being independent, and it's interesting. I've probably had now at least a dozen more artists who've come on and said the exact same thing. And what's interesting is that more artists are embracing this notion of what I call Me Inc. That it's no longer just, well, it's the labels. Wait a minute, I can be in total control of my destiny.
Absolutely.
My fan base, my social media, my own stuff. Granted, it's a lot more work. You sort of reminds me of going to be old school in terms of having the CDs in the back of the trunk.
Yeah.
But it's being in control of your own destiny.
Mm-hmm. And particularly, like, in this season where I think that people like Frank Thomas realize that instead of investing in something that's totally brand new, when you're starting a company like his, being vulnerable as well, you can go to an established artist. There are lots of established artists that have the brand already. Yes, exactly. That's identifiable, that you know, that you're building on. And you can still always go back because we always want to know who the next artist is and we want to nurture and things like that. Well, I do at least. I'm more of a mentor kind of person. But I think that they've found that formula definitely works better. And putting your hands into it makes you appreciate all sides.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Today is HBCU Giving Day. Our school of the day is Livingstone College in Salisbury, North Carolina, whose vision is to provide students with excellent liberal arts and religious education programs that prepare them for leadership and service to a global community. Go to livingstone.edu to make your donation. It's birthday shout-out time. Singer Ashanti turns 37. Former NBA player Paul Pierce turns 40. Actress Tisha Campbell-Martin turns 49. NBA coach Doc Rivers turns 56. And on this day in history, in 1914, inventor Garrett Morgan patents the gas mask. And in 1970, activist Angela Davis is arrested in New York for murder and kidnapping. She was later acquitted of all charges. I want to thank my panel for joining me today. So what do we think? What a morning we had. Barbara, what sticks with you the most? Chicago, ACA, or poor old Puerto Rico bringing its woes on itself?
November 6, 2018.
Vote.
And don't forget, Virginia, November 7th, 2017.
What's happening?
Get ready.
Okay.
Governor's race, yeah.
Governor's
get
race.
Ready.
Brandon.
I'll just say, what I learned today is just the power of black woman magic. That's all I have to say.
Yes,
I love it.
That.
All female parents.
I'm nothing to add.
Amber.
I agree.
Black woman magic, black joy,
all of it.
That is
what's going to save us. Let's keep with that energy. Keep organizing against these things and standing up for each other.
Black woman magic. Finally, this is our last show for one of the staples here at News One Now. Our one and only Miss Noni is leaving for greener pastures. Talk about black woman magic. It will be hard to imagine the show without you. From all of us here, thank you for your hard work. We wish you nothing but the best, and you will be missed immensely. Again, Noni, I hope you're hearing me. Thank you. We love you.
Thank you.
The panel loves you.
Yes,
I hope you're going to give us your phone number and your email address. You have been absolutely spectacular and a shining light for all that black women can do. Do you agree?
Oh, yes.
Agree?
Definitely.
Always.
Agree?
Agree?
All right, Noni, I hope you're hearing us. We all agree. You, my dear, are the bomb.com. Happy Friday. Have a great weekend. And I promise you, Roland Martin and I are really not on Kenny Lattimore's album. Have a great weekend.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.